Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello and welcome to As It Is, a free, daily 30-minute program designed to help you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America's Learning English branch in Washington. Today on the program, we will tell you about the second most popular sport in the world. Hundreds of millions of people follow it, but it is almost unknown in the United States. It isn't football or soccer, as Americans call it. So, what is this sport? We'll tell you in a moment. Then, as we always do on Mondays, we will bring you Jonathan Evans' technology report. This week, he tells us about the growing trend of robots taking over jobs that were once performed by humans. And as we do every weekday, we will present The Making of a Nation. Every day here at VOA Learning English, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We are a little different here at VOA Learning English. Because we exist to help you learn everyday American English, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. Two teams of cricket players will compete in three large American cities in November. They hope Americans will learn more about the sport and begin watching it, and even playing it. Organizers have been working on the project for about a year. Football, or what Americans call soccer, has for many years been the most popular sport in the world. Cricket is the second most popular sport. From Harare to Wellington, London to Islamabad, many people follow cricket like a religion. Players gain fame and launch political careers in Pakistan and India. The International Cricket Council is the sport's ruling organization. It said its website had the highest number of visitors ever during the World Cup World Tournament earlier this year. The council said its website had more than 26 million visitors and more than 225 million page views. The council says more than 1.5 billion people watched the World Cup on television. Cricket officials believe the sport has a chance of becoming more popular in the United States. With an increasing number of immigrants to the country from South Asia, the Caribbean, Australia, and New Zealand, cricket is becoming better known. But it competes with basketball, American football, ice hockey, and baseball. It is believed cricket began in England. It is similar to baseball. Both are played with a bat and a ball, for example, and there are batters, outs, and pitches. A pitcher in baseball is called a bowler in cricket. Some historians say early baseball players learned to bat by playing cricket. But baseball and cricket are also very different from one another. In baseball, when the batter hits a home run, they touch all of the bases, then go sit on the team's bench. In cricket, when a batsman hits a home run, they continue to bat until they are out, or until a set number of pitches are completed. Like baseball, whichever team scores the most runs is the winner of the game. For many years, cricket matches lasted for days. But now, most games are played in one day. In India, the game is sometimes played in just 3 to 4 hours. This popular version of the game is known as 20-20. That is the version of the game that the two teams will be playing in cities throughout the United States. Time magazine reports some of the most popular cricket players in the world will be on the teams. The teams will have some of the best international players from the past 25 years. Two famous cricket stars, Sachin Tendulkar and Shane Warne, are the team's leaders. They are known by hundreds of millions of people throughout the world. But almost no one in the United States has ever heard of them. In 2012, Mr. Tendulkar was on the cover of the famous magazine. It called him the God of Cricket and said he was the world's most famous sportsman and the world's best athlete. Mr. Tendulkar recently told the magazine he believes Americans will become fans of the game once they see it played. "You'll only learn things if you give them a try," he said. "Americans are used to watching baseball, and it's very similar to that. If Americans can start coming to the stadium, I wouldn't be surprised to see them begin to watch cricket." The games will be played in baseball stadiums in New York City, Houston, and Los Angeles. The cities were chosen because many people who live there are already interested in cricket, and because they have large numbers of people from the Caribbean or South Asia. At the games, the players will teach Americans how to play cricket, and people will be given a small book telling them about the sport. Mr. Warren says he hopes the games will answer such questions as, "What's all the fuss about? Why is it the second most popular game in the world? What's so special about this game?" Now, it's time for our weekly look at the latest technology news. Almost half of jobs in the United States are likely to be automated within the next 20 years. That shocking prediction comes from researchers at the University of Oxford in England. They think more and more machines will be doing jobs that people have always performed. As our technology correspondent Jonathan Evans tells us, robots now work in the food industry and build cars. And other robots are being programmed to welcome people as they arrive at a store or a hotel.
The workplace has become increasingly dependent on machines. It comes as no surprise that many workers are becoming concerned about the future. Among them are millennials, people who became adults since the year 2000. Nigel Dessau is a business expert. He was born in England, but now lives in Massachusetts. Mr. Dessau wrote the book, Become a 21st Century Executive. He thinks the trend away from human workers and towards robots will not go away. What we've seen in the U.S. and some of the more Western industrialized countries over the last 25 years is the removal of entry-level jobs and the removal of the simple, repetitive manufacturing jobs. Mr. Dessau says there are ways that workers, especially millennials, can get used to this new, robot-centered reality. When looking to build a career in this century, you have to think more about other sets of skills that you need to get, he says, and I typically focus on three. The first, he says, is content or substance. So that's what do you know? What do you bring that a machine doesn't know? The next value is approach. By this, he means a way of doing things. How do you get to work with other people? How can you lead a team? And finally, he says, workers should be directing their attention on their network, in other words, their contacts. Who knows what you know and what you can do? So focus less on the processes because those are what get automated. Focus more on the content and the ability to work as a team. Mr. Dessau adds that millennials often have a way of thinking which sets them apart from other generations. When you talk to that generation and you say, what do you want for a job? What you see them talking about is they want jobs they can be passionate about, jobs that fulfill some greater purpose, he says. At the end of the day, it is your career. It is your life. And you must make decisions to make your life successful, and you can't blame robots, and you can't blame automation. Don't delegate the responsibility for your success to something or somebody else. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Thanks, Jonathan. That's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. We'd love to hear from you. Our email address is learningenglish@voanews.com. That's learningenglish@voanews.com. And please know this, we read every message you send us. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from the VOA Learning English headquarters in Washington. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. The 1850s were an increasingly tense time in the United States. Most of the population lived east of the Mississippi River, but more and more people were moving west. As western areas became populated, they became official territories and then new states. The settlement of these areas once again raised the issue of slavery. A law passed in 1820 called the Missouri Compromise extended a line across the map of the United States. Slavery was legal in areas south of the line. North of the line, slavery was illegal except in the state of Missouri. 30 years later, another political compromise made slavery a local issue instead of a national one. The Compromise of 1850 said people in the Western territories could decide for themselves whether slavery would be legal or illegal. Then, in 1854, Illinois Senator Stephen Douglas proposed another measure. His legislation would also affect slavery. It aimed to make the wild western area known as Nebraska an official territory.
This is the Great Plains. This is open territory. There were Indian tribes settled out there.
Nicole Etchison is an historian. She says white settlers could not move to Nebraska because a government did not yet exist there. They wanted the U.S. Congress to open the area to settlers. Investors wanted Congress to act, too, so Nebraska could support a railroad. Nebraska lies north of the line drawn by the Missouri Compromise of 1820. As a result, slavery would be banned in the territory, but slavery was permitted in the state next to Nebraska, Missouri. Slaveholders in Missouri did not want Nebraska to become a free territory. They were afraid their slaves would flee to it. They felt threatened by the free states and territories around them. So Senator Douglas proposed that the large Nebraska area be split in two. The northern part would be known as the Nebraska Territory. The southern part, next to Missouri, would be known as the Kansas Territory. The senator said that settlers in both territories had the right to decide whether their lands would accept slavery. He argued that the Compromise of 1850 had given the same right to people in two other territories, New Mexico and Utah. And he claimed that same right was meant for the people of all future territories. Douglas noted that in the past, the federal government sought to divide free states from slave states by making a line across a map. He said, dividing up land was not the answer. He said the people in a state or territory had the right to decide for themselves. This right was known as popular sovereignty. Historian Nicole Etchison says popular sovereignty required faith in the American political process.
Stephen Douglas argued that the foundation of American political philosophy is that the people get to decide, the voters get to decide issues, and there was no reason why they couldn't decide the slavery issue, just like they decided any other political issue.
Douglas argued that the Compromise of 1850 took the place of the Missouri Compromise of 1820. The new Kansas-Nebraska Act, he said, simply recognized the fact that the Missouri Compromise was dead. A number of anti-slavery senators denounced the Kansas-Nebraska bill. They said it was part of a Southern plan to spread slavery wherever possible. They also said Stephen Douglas was using the measure for political purposes. They said he wanted to be president and was hoping to influence voters in Southern states. Opposition to the Kansas-Nebraska bill was extremely strong in the northern states. In city after city, large public gatherings were held. Businessmen organized many of the meetings. They were angry at Douglas because he had reopened the dispute about slavery. They feared that the dispute would hurt the nation's economy. Northern religious leaders also united against the bill. Thousands signed protests and sent them to Congress. Douglas criticized the clergymen. He said they should stay out of politics. In the southern United States, the Kansas-Nebraska Act caused little excitement. Most southerners were not interested in it. They believed the measure might help the cause of slavery, but they also believed it might lead to trouble. President Franklin Pierce did not like the bill. He feared it would reopen the bitter national debate about slavery. However, most members of the U.S. Senate supported the Kansas-Nebraska bill. It passed easily in the Senate. The bill had less support in the House of Representatives. The vote there was close, but the measure passed. President Pierce finally agreed to sign it into law. In exchange, congressional leaders promised to approve several presidential appointments. Supporters of the Kansas-Nebraska Act celebrated its passage. They fired cannons as the city of Washington was waking to a new day. Two senators who opposed the bill heard the noise as they walked down the steps of the Capitol building. One of them said, "They celebrate a victory now, but the echoes they awake will never rest until slavery itself is dead." The new law gave the people of Kansas and Nebraska the right to decide if slavery would be legal or illegal. The vote would depend on who settled in the territories. It was not likely that people who owned slaves would settle in Nebraska. However, there was a good chance slave owners would settle in Kansas. Groups in the South organized quickly to help pro-slavery settlers move to Kansas. At the same time, groups in the North helped free state settlers move to Kansas. Historian Nicole Etchison says some of these settlers were abolitionists who believed slavery was wrong, but many were simply white farmers looking for new lands to settle. Ms. Etchison says these farmers did not care about slavery, but they did not want to live near blacks or compete with slave labor.
It's that third group of Midwesterners who becomes crucial, because when they get out there to Kansas and they can't get a fair vote, they become radicalized against slavery.
In Washington, President Pierce appointed Andrew Reeder as governor of the Kansas Territory. Pro-slavery settlers urged Reeder to hold immediate elections for a territorial legislature. They believed they were in the majority. They wanted a vote before too many free state settlers moved in. Governor Reeder rejected the demands. he decided to hold an election, but only for a territorial representative to the National Congress. On Election Day, hundreds of men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. They voted illegally, and the pro-slavery candidate won. The same thing happened when Kansas finally held an election for a legislature. Once again, men from Missouri crossed the border into Kansas. Many of them carried guns. They forced election officials to count their illegal votes. As a result, almost every pro-slavery candidate was elected to the new legislature. Nicole Etchison says many American elections in the 1800s had examples of violence, bad behavior, and wrongdoing. But the pro-slavery Missourians were extreme.
It was obvious that there was egregious fraud in the elections in Kansas Territory.
She says population counts at the time showed fewer than 3,000 voters in Kansas Territory. But pro-slavery candidates received up to 6,000 votes. The governor ordered an investigation. The investigation showed evidence of wrongdoing in six areas. New elections were held in those areas. This time, when only legal votes were counted, many of the pro-slavery candidates were defeated. Yet there were still enough pro-slavery candidates to hold a majority. Andrew Reeder understood he was governing a bitterly divided territory. He wanted to warn President Pierce about what was happening. So Reeder went to Washington. He met with Pierce almost every day for 2 weeks. He described how pro-slavery groups in Missouri were interfering in Kansas. He said if the state of Missouri refused to deal with the troublemakers, then the national government must deal with them. He asked the president to do something. Pierce agreed that Kansas was a serious problem. He seemed ready to act. Reeder returned home and opened the first meeting of the territorial legislature. The pro-slavery majority quickly voted to move to a town close to the Missouri border. It also approved several pro-slavery measures. Governor Reeder vetoed these bills, but the legislature rejected his veto and passed the new laws. The Kansas legislature also sent a message to President Pierce. It wanted him to remove Reeder as governor. Political pressure was strong, and the president agreed. He named a new governor, Wilson Shannon. Shannon supported the pro-slavery laws of the legislature. He also said Kansas should become a slave state like Missouri. Kansas settlers, who had voted against slavery, became extremely angry. Soon, the situation became violent. The events known as Bleeding Kansas will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History, from VOA Learning English.